This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The year is 1984, and director Stanley Donen continued to baffle us with his latter-day efforts, first with his sci-fi fever dream Saturn III, and then with this film, a remake of a French sex comedy that pushed the limit of taste, nubile nudity, and uncomfortable amounts of bossa nova. This film follows longtime friends Matthew and Victor, played by Michael Caine and Joe Bologna, respectively, who are on vacation in Rio with their two young, but fully grown daughters, played by Michelle Johnson and Demi Moore. Now, as Michael Caine's Matthew struggles with his failing marriage, he is seduced by Victor's daughter, willingly, I might add. And as the two carry on their secret affair, Victor tries to figure out who the rascal that is banging his daughter in secret is, only to uncover more family secrets that will tear their friendship apart. This infamous sex comedy has been greatly maligned since its release. Do we blame the director? Do we blame the writers? Do we blame the stars? Or do we simply blame it on Rio? Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. This is a movie that I have to say I grew up with. This was like a childhood favorite. I don't understand why or how, but my mom, being like the biggest Michael Caine fan in the world, always had this film on. And I hadn't watched it since those early days. I just remembered it probably was the first time I saw female breasts in a movie. I really think so. But also, I just remembered like really liking Michael Caine because I knew who he was. I watched enough Michael Caine movies by that point. And honestly, it didn't seem that bad to me. Like, my parents didn't censor me too much. And now that I've gone back and watched this after like 30 years, I'm like, I kind of wish they did, because all of the bad press that this movie got from the critics, and it's got a 7% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it's got just all these negative tropes that go on and on about it, I'm going to say right here and now, totally justified. What are your thoughts?
This is a complete Antonio pick, I swear. I saw this when I was a teenager, and I can tell you exactly why I liked it was the boobs and Michael Caine. So this one, to me, there's a lot of elements here that really attracted me as a teenager to this movie. But I'm with you. I haven't seen this in years, and the rewatch for me didn't go as well. I liked it as a teenager, and kind of looking at it now, especially as a dad, it really makes me a little biased to it, and I can recognize a lot of the sleaze that we'll probably use numerous times in this. But to me, I think two elements really turned me off to this, which was, one, the weird taboo nudity right when we get in front of the father figure in the beginning, which was weird. And then we get into the retainer being taken out during kind of the first encounter, which was extremely weird. And it's not too far off of this show. I mean, we've kind of, in the last few episodes, we've had cousins, we've had aunts, we've had taboo relationships. So we're following a pattern here. But to me, this one, by the end of it, I can appreciate some elements to it, but it just didn't come together for me in something that's likable. I hated all of these characters.
I hated all of them too. And I think if there's one thing I hated more than the characters, it's the music. Like, these like narrative bossa nova renditions that they play throughout the whole, especially the theme song, they're just mind numbing. Like, I can't handle it. So that put me off right away. And it's funny because, like, I remembered the music. I just didn't remember hating it. Now I'm like, oh, I actually hate this. So, Okay, so if I had to play devil's advocate to this, which, you know, that's the whole point of this show, is like, this isn't just a terrible movie, even though I think it was a terrible experience. I get what it was trying to do, and like you said, it just kind of fails at it. It's a remake of a French boudoir comedy, right? That's exactly what it should be. That's exactly what it is. I haven't seen it, but I guarantee you it plays better in French. It plays better with those kind of characters and those kind of ideals. You know, the European sensibilities are a lot more, I'm not going to say progressive, but they're not as conservative as American sensibilities were, especially at this time. So you could have a sex comedy, you know, but to make it work for audiences of the 80s and even today, you have to really play it tongue in cheek. You really have to play it with the farce amplified to get away with the sex. The problem with this rendition is that the farce is on the page, but the director was not directing farce. And I like Stanley Donen. The dude was a genius, but there was something about those latter day films where it felt like he was just working for the sake of working. And that's what this movie feels like. It doesn't feel like a comedy. So it does really kind of tiptoe on that edge of just total sleaze and exploitation, but it's got the grandiose performances of people like Joe Bologna and Michael Caine. Like, it just doesn't all work, and it does come off sleazy to me. It does come off uncomfortable, and it does come off completely inappropriate. But because I've seen so many French sex comedies and boudoir farces, and like Paul Bartel movies, who is like the guy who really makes it work for American audiences, him and John Waters, I think, really know how to make that kind of that atmosphere work. It doesn't do it in this movie. And I just came out feeling just icky.
Icky is the key word here, because you shouldn't be feeling good about this movie. But I think what the issue was, the cast of writers here, I mean, it doesn't match the director's style. I mean, we have Larry Gelbart, who did Tootsie, Amazing, Bedazzled, but then we get into...
MASH.
He did
MASH.
Yeah. But then we get into Charlie Peters, that did Three Men, Little Lady, and Hot to Trot. And I know we had a conversation a while ago about that. But there are conflicting styles of writers here, and we've seen this time and time again. When we take a taboo French film that's a comedy, come over here, and it just gets torn to pieces, and it just doesn't work, and nobody seems to learn their lesson with it. So to me, this one, I can see the elements of what they're trying to do, like we said, but it just doesn't come together. And if what we try to do with this movie is, with a lot of the romance novels of the 80s, that every mom, every female in the house usually just race to the grocery store to get to read at home, it almost feels like they tried to tap into a market for men. And this is where the sleaze comes. They go more for the fantasy than they do the comedy. They go more for the taboo elements to it, and they really push the limit on that. But they put the comedy and the chaotic situations in the background. And that's where they make the misstep, is there's no balance to it, and there's no fun dialogue to it. Even when it tries to be fun, it comes across creepy and gross and icky. We like that one scene where he's shaving and he's saying no, no, no. And it's just that pressure to it. I mean, at this point, there's nothing funny about that. There's nothing that really wants me to engage with these characters. So, and our reviewers are going to say it later, but they talk a lot about the outcome of it. And to me, that is another element that just makes me feel even worse. So from the start to finish, it just tries to outdo itself on how far it can go, on how inappropriate it is. And it wants the audience to feel what it's trying to sell us. And to me, I wasn't buying it. There is nothing here that really screams engagement from me.
Well, and they sum it up perfectly, at least one of them does in the review. But I'm so glad that you brought up the writers, because it really makes me want to understand, you know, was there a division of responsibilities and duties? Because what it feels like to me, it feels like to me that Larry Gelbart came in to punch up the script, because all those little clever one-liners and little quips between Matthew and Victor, those may as well be Hawkeye and BJ Honeycutt or Trapper John quips. Like, they come right out of the MASH formula. you know, you've got the punchline followed by a clever quip to like bring you back into the story. It's very sitcom-y, but it's so obviously sitcom-y that you feel like that was added in. Like, okay, exposition, here's a quip, funny line, and someone says something sarcastic, just like in Tootsie, just like in MASH, just like any Larry Gelbart script. But this is the other problem I have, is that Michael Caine isn't funny when he needs to be. I think when he does come off funny, it's more of the physicality, less of the line delivery, because he's an amazing actor. But Michael Caine always sounds like Michael Caine no matter what he's doing, right? But these scripts are written in the sense like, if this was, let's say, Donald Sutherland and Elliot Gould coming back together after doing MASH, right, and bringing that kind of chemistry to it, that actually, in my opinion, would make it better, because now you've got people to laugh at with the delivery and with the physical performance. It matches that personality where you almost kind of forgive the sex farce and inappropriateness that is leaking behind it. But these guys are so just playing it straight that it makes them feel even dirtier, because Victor's character is terrible. You know, yes, he's going through a divorce or fresh out of a divorce, but the first thing he does is start banging people in Rio left and right with no emotional attachment. I mean, I guess that's what he's there for, but then how is he supposed to be like the subjective person of the movie, who's supposed to be giving his daughter like advice of how to not be used, abused, and exploited by men? Meanwhile, Matthew's character is supposed to be the likable one, like the one that we're supposed to, I don't know, connect with emotionally, but he's not, because he instantly has sex with a 17-year-old girl. And they really kind of talk about this, like, I wish there was a bigger debate on that, where one of our critics is almost apologetic for this interaction, and the other one just calls it for what it is. So is it a movie that offends me? I'm not going to say it offends me. I just didn't find it entertaining because the comedy wasn't there, but it tries to play itself off as a comedy. Instead, it focuses on ample nudity, which I'm not going to complain about in a movie that is, like, if it's an Andy Sidaris movie, right? Like, if it's Hard Ticket to Hawaii, that's what I signed up for. But when you look at this poster and you see these four faces and this font on this poster, and maybe even the trailer, it really passes it off for a comedy. And then when you actually watch the movie, you're like, okay, why do I feel bad for laughing or even an attempt to laugh? It definitely is the reason why I think a lot of people turned their back to this production.
Well, we look at the character development going through it, because Michael Caine never changes. Even when he's in this stressful situation, he's still, like you said, it's a Michael Caine performance. He doesn't change. He has his best friend that can potentially find out about him. He's a 17-year-old girl. He's cheating on his wife, and he has no emotion throughout the movie. So to me, that was an issue. And this is where I think could have been solved by some smart direction, where we talk about the music, and I 100% agree with that, but look at the entire scenery of it. We don't really get sucked into this Rio environment, this atmosphere. We don't get this seductive setting, and it's really focusing on a lot of these up-close shots with these characters, like we're supposed to care about them. But I want to be engulfed right into this scene. Years later, there was My Father the Hero, which wasn't a great movie, but I do give it credit because it does put you into that environment. You do see all the interactions in this environment, and we do get a feel for a different place. So to me, that's where this movie really kind of pulls back on, is really taking us in. And that would really add to justifying a little bit more to that taboo element, but also kind of distract us from the characters a little bit, where it might fool us into caring about what happens with these characters based on how they're interacting in this fun environment. So to me, I think there is a lot of misses on the direction here. And again, it's painful me to say that, because I love the director. but I think this one was completely out of his element on the way he's directing the characters and the way he directed the settings and his camera shots. It was too much of a character focus without caring about the characters. And it was a complete misunderstanding of the entertainment value of how these characters are portrayed. So to me, I think the climax of it, that would have been a better movie to focus for the entire runtime. Just if you're going to do a movie that's enclosed with these characters, have that chaotic multiple character scenes in kind of a one setting. That would have been a better movie than this. The doors closing back and forth, the confrontation. So right. To me, that would have been a better movie.
The tropes in this movie are so painfully obvious, but they don't deliver the way a trope like it should. For example, the maid should have been a bigger part of the movie because she actually is part of the punchline at the end when she walks in on Victor and Matthew in their underwear wrestling, like essentially, like, or they're fighting, but she thinks they're having like an experience. That should have been a bigger laugh because they should have done more with her. You bring in an eccentric old man neighbor who is a very charming guy. He should have been the Victor Belasco, like from Barefoot in the Park. He should have been that guy throughout the whole movie, but he only shows up like three times. He doesn't add anything to the farce, to the humor. So therefore, they just feel like wasted characters. I don't know if there's something in these guys' contracts where they have to have X amount of screen time, because really, the movie's called Blame It on Rio, and we only see Rio when there's naked people on the beach. Other than that, they're in the cabana, right? It's not... It doesn't feel like an immersive experience in another country or the exoticness of it, because we're dealing with these people who aren't very likable. I'm going to jump into the cast really fast, you know, so we both know that the two male leads, they're not likable. And, you know, God bless him, Michael Caine never met a script he didn't like or didn't take, you know, and he's one of the very few actors that could just make absolute trash, but is still held such in high regard because he never phoned it in. I've seen nearly every Michael Caine movie, and of all the Michael Caine movies where I feel like he's phoned it in, it's this one, 100%. First of all, the fact that it starts off like documentary style, where they're talking into the camera and like setting up the narrative, like they're, you know, talking heads, like this is a Werner Herzog movie. I don't understand that directorial choice, and I don't understand the choice in the script, but it totally throws us off. Because they keep intercutting the film with these moments where they're speaking straight to the camera. I don't know if they were trying to like really play up the idea that this is a European sex comedy, but it's an American-made one, and that's what they're trying to do. Whatever it was, I didn't like it. But that deadpan attitude that Michael Caine brings to the performance, the whole movie, it's disappointing, to say the least. And continuing with the tropes, like, since he's not big on physical comedy, what do they have him do? They have him do things like cut himself shaving, or one of my least favorite examples in any kind of movie, where you're holding a glass and something happens or someone says something that shocks you and the glass breaks in your hand. Go fuck yourself with that trope. I hate that trope in movies because it totally takes you out of the reality that the movie's trying to build. It's cheap. It's a cheap trick. It like came out of a dime store, right? So those things, on top of the performances, this leads me to me, the most tragic performance of the movie, and that's Michelle Johnson. It's not that she's a bad actress. It's just she's not right for this role because this was her first role. She wasn't a trained actress. And I feel like she was hired because of her innocence. And then you sully that innocence with all this, you know, unnecessary nudity. Which even to this day, she was like, I was young, I wanted the job, my parents let me do it, and as the character, it felt right. But even still, going back and watch the movie, like, was it the right choice? Like, they really have to hire a 17-year-old actress to play this role when there were 300 actresses considered, some of them big names now? It feels like the casting of her was kind of an exploitive choice, and I don't like it.
Well, she was exploited during the entire movie because any chance she can get her clothes off, her clothes is off, whether it made sense or if it didn't. So, I mean,
right.
To me, was it a smart choice back in Hollywood back then? Probably, because it probably got her some additional roles just for going above and beyond what she needed to do for this role. So, unfortunately. But does it really test her range? Absolutely not. She is treated as an object, and that's what her delivery is treated as, is an object. She's there as almost a prop because she has simplistic lines. Right. She has simplistic responses. There is nothing that goes in depth. Here is a character that has so much almost trauma that we want to see come out. She has parents that are going through a divorce. You have an overbearing father. And obviously she's attracted to a man in his 40s. So there is trauma here that is treated so subtly and like it doesn't exist because it's going to ruin the feel of the movie, which doesn't have a feel in the first place. So to me, this one is an underwritten character because it doesn't want to ruin that farce cheesiness that it thinks it's doing, but it could have gone a lot farther with this character. But we see a lot of actresses in the 80s treated like this. And unfortunately, this one is probably one of the worst ones that I've seen when it comes to exploitation of a new actress in a movie.
Right, because the movie isn't like a grindhouse film. It's not like a drive-in genre movie. This movie is supposed to be like a credible motion picture from a big studio with big names, with a big director, with big writers, yet somehow it feels more inappropriate than a Roger Corman skin flick, you know? And it's really apparent too with Demi Moore in one of her first roles, how uncomfortable she is in these scenes. Like you see her trying to cover up on the beach. You see her almost acting like she's ashamed in this movie. And when she is on screen, she is kind of like supposed to be the bummer character. Okay, she's a bummer because she knows that her dad is sleeping with her best friend. And so she's sad and depressed about it, but she's not saying anything because she doesn't want to ruin the family and friendship dynamic. That's the most tragic character in this movie. And she's treated like a milestone around their necks, right? Like, oh, what a bummer she's being. She's not having fun. She doesn't want to go out dancing because she's sitting on this big secret that could literally wreck everything. And the justifications too at the end, like they talk about when we get to the reviews of like, okay, so nothing bad happens to anybody. Like everything actually turns out great. You know, Michael Caine doesn't go to jail for statutory rape. Oh, don't worry, you're having an affair with my best friend. Because I was sleeping with your daughter, it's all a wash, right? Like everyone just goes back to normal. I mean, the justifications that they force on us towards this movie of like why we're supposed to laugh, like, oh, it's a farce. I'm like, no, all these people need to like die in a fiery car crash, right? And then like the kids can grow up and deal with their trauma through therapy and hopefully be better than their parents. But that's not what we get. Instead, we get like that traditional farce ending of like, oh, well, yes, he divorced his wife and then they got remarried again. It's like, the comedy, it probably looked good on paper. It maybe even looked good in test screenings, but something about the final project, the final way they like cut and pasted it together and threw that terrible music on it and then threw those terrible let's look in the camera and tell you what's going on moments. Dude, I just couldn't.
All of those elements are missed opportunities because let me be careful with what I'm about to say. The narration,
yeah, be careful.
The narration moments, I wouldn't have had a problem with if they did something with them that makes sense. If it was Michael Caine's conscience going back and forth with more clarity, I can see that. But this one's just Michael Caine speaking, and I didn't really care about it. He didn't add any relevance to moving the story forward, so it was stupid. When we get to the final act, this is where I kind of said earlier it should have been a different movie because it is like a light switch where you have the fight on stage where everybody's a suspect on who's sleeping with his daughter. We get to the additional add-on character, the wife coming to visit, and then that's supposed to be a little chaotic farce. And it is, I hate the easy way out where we transition these climaxes, just flip a switch, and hopefully everybody's going to buy that you had a good time at this movie. And one of our critics did buy it, and that's what really drove me nuts. But this one, it just amplifies why we shouldn't like these characters, because in the beginning, I forgot how this movie ended. And during my rewatch, when we get to it, I was trying to remember how this movie ended. And when we get there, I just shouted, come on, because this isn't a wash. You're all assholes. Everybody should go their separate ways. So how you're going to turn cheating and misery into something that's of a happy ending is beyond me. And for a filmmaker to try and attempt this, you have to have the world of confidence, and rightfully so, he should. He's done some great work, but not in this material because it's absolute garbage.
I think at the end of the day, my final take on this movie and like this story is, I'm not going to say like it's a xenophobic thing, but when I watch a French comedy or a German comedy or even like a Swedish erotic film, you know, they all were very whimsical, right? You could watch like Swedish erotica, yet there would be pratfalls and there would be farce and comedy in there to kind of keep you immersed that you're watching a movie, you're not just watching a skin flick. They were very good at that. And there's something about it, if it's in a different language from a different country and it's not played for the cheap laughs that Americans expect, I don't get as, you know, nervous or uncomfortable in watching those. In fact, I can have a pretty damn good time. So many of those 70s sex farces from France are hilarious. I mean, La Cage aux Folles is hilarious. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's that era, it's that type of film, it's that type of performance. And that had a successful remake because they didn't go the exploitive route. There's a lot more queer-centric undertones in La Cage aux Folles than there is in The Birdcage, right? But The Birdcage understood what the American audiences are used to. And what this film does is they try to justify the sex and the eroticism and the inappropriate situations. They try to justify it with jokes, with sitcom cheap laughs that don't deliver. Therefore, you do not have enough to separate the ick from the funny. And that's the biggest problem with this movie.
And we look at a lot of the French comedies and movies like this that rely a lot on body language. They rely a lot on amplifying your verbiage while you're actually acting. Here, what happens right when we do this, and we even saw from The Birdcage to an extent, is translating that really straight to the point delivery of comedy body language, it transitions into a sloppy fall, a drop of the glass, something that's just silly, that really doesn't add anything to the dialogue or interpretation of it. It just comes across as cheap laughs and a grab. And that's where another reason this movie misses is because, one, you get props that act as a supplement to the comedy, like the dropping of the glass. Then you have stiff characters. You have Michael Caine that doesn't do anything. You have nobody that really is having fun in Rio except for sleeping with each other. So there's really nothing here to separate that, to show to the tradition of what makes a French film so unique and so interesting to watch, especially if you're watching the subtitles. There's an interpretation that we have to take away from the physical performance as well as the verbal performance.
Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. Like I said before, it sits at a 7% on Rotten Tomatoes. Vincent Canby tore it apart. Many, many critics tore it apart. We're going to jump into our critics' reviews in a second, but then Roger Ebert, in his written review, he tore it apart even more than he did on the show, and we'll get to that. So let's go ahead and start hearing what these guys had to say. This was Gene's episode to bring the show on.
Blame It on Rio is sort of an imitation of the hit film 10, this time taking place all among friends. As for the whole film, that kind of younger girl, older man fantasy has been popular in a lot of films of late, sociologically, I think it's some kind of reaction to the strong women's movement. Men want to see men dominate women in the movies, I think.
Okay, so sexist right off the bat. Like, when I first heard that, I was like, did he really just say that? I mean, I guess it is 1984, but goddamn, Gene. Okay, so yeah, I get it. Just because 10 was popular doesn't mean that 10 was the originator of this genre. It had been around for a while. That's the one that just happened to make a lot of money. And yes, lots of people jumped on that bandwagon to make a film that was very much like 10. The difference with 10 and this one is that we're not dealing with an underage girl in that one, right? We're dealing with like a young free spirit and Dudley Moore, right? And Dudley Moore has been 60 years old since he was 20 years old. That's just his character, right? In everything. So I think that is a good example of where we're at in the 80s, right? And what comedies are and what we're getting away with and what we're setting up. But the comment of like, oh, it's the strong women's movement that is making comedies like this so popular. I mean, I was 3 years old in 1984, so I really don't have a place to say. But I tell you, common sense tells me that's probably not it. It's probably horny old men that are making the money for these movies.
Well, this drives me nuts on it because he acts like this is a new concept in movies. Going through the right. 70s, going through, this is 84, he saw probably about 50 movies prior to this in the last 6-7 years. So the main difference is the key word of sex here is they're utilizing the sex sells tickets. They're utilizing the marketing of not just the male dominating the female. Hollywood is trying to capture the market of horny men. It has nothing with reaction of the women's movement. This is just marketing for men that want to have that fantasy, and it's done in a sleazy way. Now, whether that was the intent or not, that's a whole different story. If they wanted it sleazier, the better. But I can't see that given the filmmakers. But this has nothing to do, because there's more exploitation in a lot of other films leading up to this that are a little bit more graphic than just seeing nudity, even though I do think it's an exploitation film to an extent, but not as much as what we've seen in the past.
Well, it makes me wonder what my mom really saw in this movie, because I knew she liked Michael Caine, but I was like, this was on all the time as a kid. So I don't understand what the factor was that made her be so appreciative and entertained by this movie. I should have called her and asked her before we started recording. But women did like this movie too. Do I put it on the same level of like women going crazy over the 50 Shades of Grey book or movie or adaptation or Twilight even for that matter? It feels different. And maybe there's something that's more kind of fantastical about it. Like, oh, I wish I was young and pretty again and could, you know, make love on the beach with a successful older man. Maybe that's it. I'm not going to ask my mom that, but there's got to be a reason, right? Anyway, they continue.
Blame It on Rio is a bit preposterous in the beginning and in the middle. Now, how can I come back and recommend the movie after that? That's because it did win me over at the end, not with a comedy scene, not even with a sex scene. It won me over with a strong scene of forgiveness. And that caught me by surprise, and I went out of this picture thinking about that as much as the sex in the beginning.
Bullshit. That's like saying you read Playboy for the articles and not the photos. He is not fooling me one goddamn second.
Well, we get into this argument, too, is when we critique a movie, are we solely basing it off of how it ends? We spend an hour and 40 minutes with these characters that we just completely, he even admits it, first act horrible, second act, whatever, and then the ending sold him. So you're giving your thumbs up based on the climax. Give me a break. So that is not holistically the way to recommend a movie, saying, hey, buy a ticket, wait an hour and 15 minutes, then go in. That's not what people are looking for when it comes to a critique on a TV show. And bullshit on the, he was sold from the first bit of nudity. So shut up. But he loved the nudity and he loved the fact that it all ended with a happy ending and nobody got arrested.
Right. But that's the thing is like the forgiveness, that's not the strongest point of the movie. I mean, the only reason why there's any, I'm going to say, forced forgiveness there is the fact that Valerie Harper is there as the ex-wife who they've revealed that she's been cheating on Michael Caine with the Joe Bologna character, which, first of all, yuck. But it's her who's just like, hey, we're all going through a midlife crisis right now. I had to go to another island to get away from you and think about what my future is. Meanwhile, I gotta say that the Victor character is probably worse than Matthew, because the whole time he's trying to get Matthew to help him find the guy who's sleeping with his daughter, he's literally plotting to move in with Matthew's wife and steal her away from him. And the whole time they're like best friends. It goes back to that idea of like, how are we supposed to relate to these people, right? If nothing bad happens to disgusting people at the end of the movie, and I'm not even going to say bad, if they don't face any kind of accountability or repercussion, then what was the point of this 90-minute movie that we just watched, right? Like, I don't want to watch the shitty people get everything they ever wanted at the end of the movie, you know? Unless you're doing it very ironically or sarcastically. Like, if you're doing it funny game style, right? Where, like, the two worst dudes in the world just get away with it scot clean, right? That's different. That's meant to piss you off. But you're supposed to like this. This is supposed to be an uplifting ending and an uplifting movie. I'm like, no, it's not.
Well, and if it's trying to tap into that relatability factor of midlife crisis fantasy, the one thing that I would find extremely hard, and I was struggling watching this, was the relatability of your best friend sleeping with your daughter, and everybody's okay with this. There is no conflict there. They sit in silence. They ask if he wants them to hit Michael Caine, whatever it may be. There is no reaction here. And I think this is what confuses me, is Gene had a daughter at this point too. It's almost human nature to really have a reaction saying, that ain't happening. You know what? I'm going to sleep with your wife 50 more times, and I'm still not going to feel better about this situation. So there is no relatability with any of these characters other than the idea of a midlife crisis. And they're using that to justify some horrible characters. So to me, it is rotten. It is gross. And like I said before, there is no justification. All these characters need to run for the hills from each other.
Well, and then they make it even worse by even further victimizing Michelle Johnson's character, because she does feel the guilt. She does feel the anxiety of like, oh my God, you know, what did I do? Why is this, you know, this family's falling apart because of something that I did. She's trying to go in there and say something. They keep shutting her up. And then she goes and attempts suicide by overdosing on birth control pills. So, okay, let's make suicide a joke. You're right. Again, they're just further victimizing that character, which just makes the adult in this movie even more despicable. Anyway, before it gets too yucky, Roger jumps in to kind of save the day.
I don't think the ending of the picture quite redeemed it for me. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I think that you're right to compare it to 10. Mm-hmm. I think that they're trying to get the same kind of chemistry between Michael Caine, who's a very good actor, and Michelle Johnson, I think her name is, who was the Bo Derek person in this.
Would be, not quite.
It's a matter of taste, but obviously she's supposed to be that kind of person. But the difference is the relationship has this enormous age difference, and she is really young. She is not Bo Derek, 19 or 20. She is a child, and that is potentially such a serious subject matter that the idea that they treat it as a situation comedy with who's going to jump out the window when somebody else comes in the door just doesn't fit.
He is 100% right. I couldn't agree with him any more than that. And that's one of the things where it's like, I feel where we speak Roger's language is, if you're going to be an exploitation movie, which we're going to cover one in a few weeks, which does it the right way, in my opinion, you are relieving yourself of the social accountability of what you're trying to say the message of your movie is, right? Like, to me, a lot of those genre exploitation films where there's like sexual assault, but then revenge, it's actually, in a roundabout way, a strong feminist movement in the sense of, we're not going to be abused by men anymore. We're going to be Miss 45, and we're going to go blow their dicks off. They tore movies like that apart on this show, but it kills me that this movie lets the victim be further victimized and then left to their own devices. You're going to let your 17-year-old daughters stay in Rio by themselves for another 2 months unaccompanied? Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And Gene gives it a pass. Like, that's where every few episodes, I get so enraged at the contradictory nature of this guy. And this is like one of the worst so far.
Well, and this goes into contradicting Gene too, because we've said it before, he has a huge thing when it comes to exploiting kids in horror movies, but sex, okay. So
sex comedy is fine.
Who cares? But here's where, knowing Roger, this is where it surprises me, is that nobody asks a question, why couldn't we make this character 18, 19, 20? What would be the difference if you're not going to do anything with this age? So, because they rarely kind of bring it up. To an extent, there's not a real exploitation on the age per se, because to me, I can't remember a lot of scenes that really just focus on the age. Would it have been really different to increase the age and just have these young adults have the same concept? So it's still the overlaying theme of sleeping with the daughter, but it really makes more sense if you're not really going to do anything with the subject matter of her being a minor, because they really don't. They just kind of hang it over our heads and say, this is taboo, just go along with it. So to me, I think it would have been a better, smarter move to really ask those questions of what was the intent if you weren't going to really go forward with this concept.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, what we're saying is that the studios have already been doing that for years. Like, they already push unbelievable age gaps in these relationship comedies. You know, Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, or even worse, the Winona Ryder Richard Gere one. It's like, what the fuck was that? You know, that's natural. People are almost accustomed to seeing a 50-year-old guy and a 20-something or maybe even late teen be in a relationship, and we don't even bat an eye. So if there has to be a taboo to make the story work, then you got to make her 17. And to top it off, you got to make her 17 in real life too, which still blows my mind. Anyway, they debate a little bit, and we get like our final kind of resolution to the conversation.
Film approaches sleazy. Mm-hmm. There's no getting around that.
It approaches it real, real closely.
Yeah, and at the same time, and I had that reaction, mm-hmm. I just say that at the very end, I felt it justified getting close to sleazy. It can be a moral question. We can debate that. But in movie terms, I felt it justified it marginally. I'm not the biggest fan of this picture.
In movie terms, maybe, but I think it raises some real real important issues and just totally dismisses them, because to even look at them for a little bit would mm-hmm. ruin their whole idea of this lighthearted comedy. Mm-hmm.
So he nailed it right on the head. If you don't keep the jokes coming, if you don't keep the scenes and the music and all that nonsense to distract you from what the movie really is, then you just realize that you fucked up and you made a movie that nobody should see. Like, it should have never left the editing room. It shouldn't have. And it kills me that Gene's like trying to even justify it. And here's the thing. You can make the argument or the debate that he's trying to make, but not give it a thumbs up. You can say, like, you know what? I enjoyed it, but these are the things that I feel just didn't make this movie a thumbs up worthy picture. But he didn't do that. Instead, he backpedaled a lot, gave the movie a thumbs up, and tried to patch together this justification of forgiveness that will marginally, as he says, compensate all the inappropriate things the movie presents. And Roger just wasn't having it.
As he shouldn't, because he doesn't really give any justifications to justify it other than the key word of forgiveness. And nothing's really
it's forgiven to an extent.
It's a to be continued. Right. So it's a settlement. So there is nothing that justifies the actions of these men in this movie. So to me, I would have loved to read or see the review that really zeroes in on what made this climax so impactful that it's going to justify the entire movie, because I didn't see it. And I'm, from what I'm hearing, I'm sure you didn't see it. There is nothing in that climax that justifies a redemption.
Right. So in his written review, Roger gave it 1 star, and I liked this part of his critique. It said, "It's really unsettling to see how casually this movie takes a serious situation. A disturbed girl. She's disturbed. She is disturbed very much so, from her parents' divorce to being at a prep school where she tells Demi Moore, oh, I've already had lots of experience. I'm not a virgin like Uncle Matthew says, right? Disgusting. A disturbed girl is using sex to play mind games with a middle-aged man, and the movie gets its yucks with slapstick scenes. What's shocking is how many first-rate talents are associated with the sleaze. And that's what I was talking about. It's like, okay, so we are going to give you a sitcom pratfall or MASH wisecrack to chuckle at in hopes that we are going to not pay attention to how disturbing the actual characters are and the story that is trying to tell us and trying to get us to accept. I'm telling you right now, this is one of Roger's best takes on this film, because it's not only a good critique on a film that I think is pretty lousy. He's really speaking to the responsibility of filmmakers, of storytellers, and of actors, where it's like, if you felt strongly about the script, if you felt really strongly about this story, and you thought it was going to make a great movie and that you could bring some bravado to it and make the project work and, in Gene's words, justify the content, if you felt so strongly about that movie, then you wouldn't have a movie like this. Instead, I feel like everyone in this movie just took a paycheck and were just like, well, I hope people don't hate me for making a film like this. I feel that Gene's in the same way. Like, I feel like halfway through his defense of the film in this debate, that he's like, should I keep speaking right now? Or should I just let Roger finish and we'll move on to the next movie? You see it in his face of like, I'm already mid-thought and the camera's rolling. I gotta finish this statement. And it's either gonna sink me or it's going to justify everything I just said. And it sunk it.
Well, you can even see it when his words start to just downturn. Like, he's ashamed of himself.
Yep.
He doesn't. You see it.
You see it.
He doesn't make eye contact because he's ashamed of his comment. But he knows it, but it's too late between these two. But you touched on it with Roger's review. Is this is a disturbed young individual that really doesn't focus on anything. It's almost borderline Alicia Silverstone or Crush or Basic Instinct. It's a lot of these very teetering. They teeter on, well, it's teetering really sleazy. No, it's teetering on a character almost being psychotic because of the obsession with this man as well. So, and I don't know if they're trying to portray it that way or if it's trying to show the obsession of wanting love with this older man. I don't know, because the movie doesn't make that clear. But the movie, again, teeters back and forth, and I think Roger's 100% right, and I salute him for pointing out the obvious, because it's so easy for a critic to ignore the obvious when it comes to these characters and a lot of underlying issues that are becoming surface level by the end of the movie. So I think with him, it is a very well-written review, and I think it is a shame that this one, I really wanted this review and this argument to go on another 5-10 minutes so we can see Roger really make Gene ashamed of his last comments.
Oh, and just for like the cinema appreciative crowd, like I consider myself to be, you know, when you get on Letterboxd, this has got a 2.6, and there are so many reviews that have no star rating because even common people who are on Letterboxd don't want to put a rating on this because they are afraid to have someone say, oh, you gave that 3 stars? Are you a fucking pervert? Like, it's true. Tons of reviews, but not a lot of ratings. And we've seen this before in other movies that we've covered where it's like, huh, I wonder why they didn't put an actual star rating on their Letterboxd review. It just goes to show that in the zeitgeist, this movie makes people uncomfortable. And, you know, the few people that defend it, like my mom, I'm sure there's a naivete to that where she's like, oh, but he's so funny in it. I love Michael Caine, you know? Ugh. And she has a son, not a daughter, you know? There's lots of variables to people's review and appreciation of this movie. So when it comes down to the rating of the critics, this is by far my least favorite Gene Siskel review, 100%. It's my least favorite in the sense of the moral responsibility he has as a television host. It's my least favorite of the justification that he's trying to defend this lousy movie with. Like, it does not deserve a thumbs up. Even if it had all those little factors that I said earlier that would make it a better movie, even then, I don't think it deserves a thumbs up. So the dude's getting an F minus on this one from me.
Totally fair, because his review really portrayed like he saw Playboy for the first time. He was very giddy. So now with Roger, again, one of my favorite ones, because this isn't just a film review, it's journalism. He really does report on the topic. He reported on the movie, and he brought this topic to light of what it's trying to do and why you should feel gross about it. So to me, this one is going to be probably my highest rating with him so far at 4 stars.
Yeah, it's 100% the most, I'm not going to say it's my favorite review of his, but it's the one I respect him the most for. Like, it takes a lot to, or maybe it doesn't, but I feel like when you are in an industry that kind of caters to the obscene, it kind of caters to the behind the scenes, behind closed doors, casting couch mentalities that everyone knows exist. We just pretend it doesn't. To be able to stand up for what is justifiably right in a moral aspect, and I'm progressive as fuck. Like, I say, hey, you want to get your tits out? Get your tits out. Don't try and paint a glossy picture of what this film actually really is, which is dirty old men writing a movie about dirty old men. Like, that's just not something that I need to see. And I guarantee you that the French version definitely has the irony that this one so poorly lacks to make us understand why people do the things they do.
And let's not forget the time period here where the moral compass of journalism in Hollywood, they weren't really looked up to when it comes to their morals. And to me, I think this one is out of character for any film critic in the early 80s to really bring to light. So it's, to me, this is what really made Roger special when it comes to how he told the story on reviewing a movie and how he portrayed a message in his actual journalism.
And like I said, when I put this movie on the list, it wasn't to have a conversation like this. It was literally like, I remember my mom loving this movie. I remember there being boobies in it. It's supposed to be funny. What does 43-year-old me think of this movie, since I haven't watched it in 30 years or more? And I didn't think that I was going to be so emotionally invested in this conversation, because I didn't think that this stupid little movie was going to get at me so much. And it did, which makes me feel better about myself.
Well, as you should. It's adult responsibility. Kids, we have the mindset of some of the topics. I think that movie was more made for teenagers and kids than it was actually for adults that actually have a moral compass, most of us, on the way things should be treated. So, and this is a perfect example of what not to do and how not to treat anybody, let alone females.
100% agreed. Okay, great conversation. I don't suggest this film. I'm not trying to get you to go watch it. Don't let us know what you think about it. Just let it alone. Let it die. So next week, it's Justin's pick, and he is bringing a comedy which, it just like The Secret of My Success. I saw it as a kid, but I have very little recollection of what it is, and that is She's Out of Control, starring Tony Danza.
I figured it was a good tie-in after this episode of the father-like figure, but we'll see. I haven't rewatched it in years. I just remember the review, and I remember liking it as a kid, so we'll see how it goes.
And Tony Danza should have made more movies.
Really should have.
Like, literally, he had this, and then the one with Danny DeVito where they're raising orangutans.
Angels in the Outfield.
Oh, and Angels in the Outfield. That's right. Cool, cool. Okay, everyone, so you know what to do. Get onto YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, like, rate, review, give us 5 stars, type up what you like about the show. We want to share everyone's reviews of our reviews to our audience and let people know that they're listening and discovering the show. Also, you can suggest a film for us to cover. As long as Siskel and Ebert reviewed it on the show, we'll cover it. So get into Facebook, Instagram, Twitter/X, and suggest a film to us, or in our YouTube comments, because that's where we're getting a lot of chatter right now. So, Justin, I can't say it was a pleasure because I had to watch this movie, but at least I can purge it from my system.
At least I know to take it out of my library. So that's a win in my book. So thanks, Antonio.
You're welcome. Everyone, thank you very much for watching/listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.